for this afternoon and tonight, a significant winter storm, including heavy snow with blowing and freezing snow.
Hello and welcome to the Snow Brains Podcast, where it's my job to interview the most intelligent people in the snow sports industry and pass their fascinating knowledge on to you, our listeners. I'm your host, Miles Clark. I'm a professional free skier, a mountain guide, an Alaska heli ski guide, a UC Berkeley molecular cell biology graduate, the founder and CEO of Snow Brains, and I dislocated my shoulder last week on February 18th. I did it over rotating a backflip at Palisades Tahoe. I was able to pop it back in myself within 3 minutes. Initially, I was devastated, thinking I'd have to stop skiing for a few weeks or more. But only 3 days later, it felt pretty damn good, and I ended up going back up to Palisades Tahoe and ended up throwing and landing a backflip that day. Since then, my range of motion has come back and my pain is sitting at zero. I truly do not recommend skiing right after a shoulder dislocation, and I'm very grateful that I was able to. This was my fourth major skiing injury. I broke my face in three places in 2011 doing a front flip at Alta, Utah. I broke my kneecap hitting a tree in Japan in 2013, and I blew my ACL and more in my left knee in 2015 off a cliff in Japan in 2015. Fingers crossed for no more injuries for a long damn time. Today's episode of the Snow Brains Podcast is brought to you by Club Med. Escape to one of Club Med's more than 20 mountain resorts in Europe, Japan, Canada, or China, where you'll find world-class skiing and snowboard terrain, exceptional service, and endless adventure. With their all-inclusive packages, you'll get everything you need for an unforgettable ski vacation, all taken care of. Lift tickets, ski and snowboard lessons for all ages and ski levels, gourmet meals, lively après-ski activities. Visit www.clubmed.us. Call 1-800-CLUB-MED or call your travel advisor today. My guest today is Dr. Kevin Stone. Dr. Stone is a physician, orthopedic surgeon, clinician, researcher, inventor, and founder of the Stone Clinic and the Stone Research Foundation in San Francisco, California. Dr. Stone's clinical work has focused on repairing and replacing meniscus, articular cartilage, and ligaments to keep people active. His clinic treats people from around the world who come for biologic joint and tissue repair and robotic artificial knee replacement. Dr. Stone's public nonprofit foundation, the Stone Research Foundation, focuses on basic science and outcome studies that are mainly concentrated on cures for arthritis and techniques to speed the return for athletes to sports. Hello, Dr. Stone. Welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being here. How are you?
Great. And yourself?
I'm very happy. I'm having a good day. And I am curious, when did you ski last?
We went up to Sugar Bowl to get a day ski in last Friday.
And Sugar Bowl, that's in Lake Tahoe, California.
In Lake Tahoe.
How many days have you skied this season?
Not as much as I would love to ski. This has been a tricky season for us for a whole host of reasons. But still, you know, we get our time in. We were over to Alta early on in the year when we had that first big dump in early December.
Oh, so yeah.
Alta fix in early, which is really important in life.
That is important in life. I got mine in just about then, too. If it was up to you, how many days would you like to ski per year?
You know, about 30 if I could.
That's perfect.
Yeah.
Nice. That's a good number. Well, let's start off with your life story. I'm very curious. I think it's a cool way to connect with people, figure out where they're coming from and where they're headed. So if you don't mind, if you could tell us your quick and dirty life story in 3 minutes, if it goes over, that's fine. But I'd love to hear your life story.
Well, I grew up in Rhode Island. So as a kid, you know, we would ski up in New England, driving up for the ice, which we get very good on the ice. And then went to Harvard for college, down to North Carolina for medical school, because if you go to Harvard, you have to go to the South to learn how to be a gentleman. And then went back to Harvard for internal medicine and came out to Stanford for general surgery. And then went back to Harvard for orthopedics, went down to New York for a research fellowship, and then went out to Lake Tahoe to do my clinical fellowship with Dick Steadman back in 1986. And It was then that he looked at my bowed legs and I'd had my meniscus taken out. And he said to me, listen, Kevin, if you'd ever figure out how to replace the meniscus, you'd make a big contribution to orthopedics. And in my typical young Harvard arrogant way, I said, great, I'll do it. You pay for it. And together we started our first company together and I created and invented the first collagen scaffold for regrowing the meniscus cartilage in people's knees. And then I moved to San Francisco when he then moved to Vail and opened my practice here. It's called the Stone Clinic in San Francisco. And I divide my life between clinical practice, where I'm treating patients for a knee, shoulder, and ankle injuries, not-for-profit research, when we have a public nonprofit research foundation called Stone Research, and you see that stonerecerch.org, and then for-profit research, when I'm inventing something that we invent and start a company around or license out to somebody. So three things I do all week on the research and work side, and then here, since I live in San Francisco, we Alta is our closest skier in our mind. So we go over to Utah to ski and we windsurf from May till October and water ski and run and bike and play all the rest of the year.
Fantastic. So that's interesting. Stedman started in Lake Tahoe. I did not know that. Was he in South Lake Tahoe?
Yes.
Very interesting. Cool. Thank you for that. And how old are you, Dr. Stone?
I'm 68.
Wow. And so, and you're still doing all these things. So I think that one thing cool about what you do is that you live the lifestyle that you talk about and treat. You don't just talk about it.
Oh yeah. It's important. It's part, first of all, it's part of the fun of doing something every day that makes you happy. So we've got a pretty clear family religion. And that is that you do four things every day, educate yourself, contribute to the world, be a good person and have fun. And if you do those four things every day, you'll probably have a good day every day.
I'm going to write those down. That's phenomenal. I like that a lot. So just to start, and I know this might be almost too broad of a question, but open-ended questions are key on these podcasts. Dr. Stone, what can you do for skiers and snowboarders with damaged knees?
A lot. So if the damages are those that don't require surgical repair, I think you're pretty well aware of now that we're in the anabolic era of sports medicine. In the past, we used to give people non-steroidal anti-inflammatories and inject steroids into their knees and joints. And now we avoid doing that like the plague. And we give people PRP and we give people anabolics and lubrication of hyaluronic acid. And have all these tools that when working with rehab and great exercises help a lot of knee, shoulder, and ankle injuries recover without surgery. If it's a injury that requires surgical repair and we've gotten smarter about which ones do and which ones don't, then it's better in general to repair them early and help people avoid going down the arthritis pathway. And then I see so many people from around the world who have been told that they need a knee replacement. And it turns out that 80% of the world, 80% of the folks who have been told they need a knee replacement actually don't. They could have other things. They could have a biologic knee replacement where I put a new meniscus back in their knee, regrow their articular cartilage, rebuild their ligaments. That's a biologic knee replacement. We can talk about some more. Mm-hmm. Or they could have a partial replacement where I use a robotic arm to just resurface only the damaged part of the knee and saving their ACL and saving the rest of the knee that might not be so severely damaged. And then if they do need a knee replacement, that's improved quite a bit as well. It's all robotic now. It's all an outpatient procedure. It takes about an hour and a half to do it. Because we don't use cement anymore for these things, we can get people back to full sports and not limit their activities. So I have lots of skiers who are skiing on either biologically replaced knees or partially replaced or fully replaced. But it's a sort of a trajectory of what you need to do. And the goal is to do the least amount possible in order to get a healthy athletic knee.
That's fantastic. And all that's really exciting. And we are, I am going to use this to get a free consultation, by the way. So we're going to move into my knee issues, but we'll stay more general here for a little bit. But all of that was really exciting. And hopefully, anyway, actually, before I'll interrupt myself, one thing I get a lot of people asking me about is meniscus surgery. And I've heard that meniscus surgery is now kind of on the out, that some of the latest studies show that people who get meniscus surgery versus people who don't get meniscus surgery end up with similar outcomes.
So that's really misinformation. And that study was done really looking at arthritic knees, where the question is, if you resect a degenerative meniscus, Is it better to do that or leave it alone? And if you're not going to put something back in, then it might be better to leave it alone, or no difference in leaving it alone. However, most of the people that I see with a degenerative meniscus also have arthritic spurs and loose bodies and synovitis and scar tissue. And so the reason for surgery is always much more complicated than just the degenerative meniscus.
Okay.
And we're just about to publish a paper on meniscus replacement in patients over 50. And it turns out that for these arthritic knees who come in, they've been told they need a knee replacement. They've only really worn out one side of their knee. They're not yet to bone on bone. In that population, we put a new meniscus back in and studied them in a 2 to 20 year outcome study. And those patients that went on to have a partial replacement did so at an average of 9.8 years or so. So they got 9 years of relief on a biologic replacement.
Wow.
And 50% of the patients in that study never went on to get any arthroplasty at all. So they're continuing to ski on their what we call a bio knee. So I think the whole thinking about how you can put meniscus shock absorbers, I get so many patients who say, hey, doc, isn't there just a shock absorber you can put back in my knee? I'm not ready for a joint replacement. That's a very common thing in our clinic, and we're putting them in every week now.
So resect means just to completely remove for our audience. And then also, where do you get these replacement meniscus, or is it meniscus?
Unfortunately, from young people who fall off their motorcycle, which is why we call them donor cycles.
Got it. Okay, cool. I know my family is a medical family too, and motorcycles have always been against the rules for those exact reasons. Okay, so you get them from a cadaver and you were able to put them in. And I did read something on your website about how you would wash them and take off antigens. Is that something you do with a meniscus as well? So that the body won't react to it negatively immuno-wise.
Yeah, that's work that we did in using pig tissue to replace human tissue. And when we do human to human, we really don't need to remove the antigens because humans are so similar to other humans.
Terrific. Okay. So you can take a cadaver meniscus, replace it, and have pretty great results, as you explained.
Indeed.
So let's take one step back. So what can skiers and riders, snowboarders, do to prevent knee injuries?
So the most common reason I see injuries from all sports, but especially in skiing and boarding, they're mental errors. So your head wasn't in the game. If you ask most folks who get injured on the snow, they almost always know the second before they made some mistake. They were going too fast. They edged just in a weird way. They took a turn they knew they shouldn't. Their mind wasn't there. They were thinking about their phone or their girlfriend or boyfriend or work or something. And so the best advice I can give to all of our athletes going out on the snow is leave the phone behind, leave the troubles behind, be in the moment, ski and enjoy the skiing. And if you do that, you'll avoid a huge number of avoidable errors. That's number one.
Love that. Yeah. If there's more numbers, keep going. But I just dislocated my shoulder 4 days ago, and it was exactly that. I turned my brain off for a second and did something I shouldn't have done. But continue if there's more.
I hear that every day.
And, yeah, I'm sure.
If I could only give you a little switch that when you go to the hill, you flick that switch and leave everything else behind, you'd stay out of my office.
Absolutely. Well, I like that as a great starting point. And are you able to share any stories of skiers or snowboarders who have found success via your procedures?
Sure. We have lots of folks who are skiing on, you know, at every level. I traveled for a dozen years with the U.S. ski team on the women's alpine side. So I had the good fortune to care for lots of great skiers over many years. And our patient population here in San Francisco, there's lots of skiers as well of all ages. And I think what we've seen is older and older skiers, folks who want to ski into their 70s and 80s and do so safely, and people who want to do more things on the snow. The beauty to great skis these days is they're so easy to turn, and beauty to high-speed lifts is there's so much more time on the snow. So from that point of view, skiing's so much better. From an injury point of view, though, it means their risk exposure time is much more because you're actually on the snow much more than you're on the chairlift anymore. Mm-hmm. And what that means is that we didn't get to 2, 3, and 4, but what that really means is that you should expect when you're going out to ski for the day that you're doing more exercise than you may have ever done in the gym, or you may have ever done even on your bike or in the pool or even running. So training for skiing and fitness for skiing, all the components of fitness from balance and coordination and proprioception and strength and, you know, cardiovascular conditioning all really do matter. So that, again, if your head is in the game and you notice you're getting tired, you know, after lunch or towards the afternoon, it's not a shameful thing to take the rest of the day off. You'll enjoy the next day more.
I love that. So yeah, let's go back to that previous question. So tip number one was, you know, have your mind completely switched on, and then take us through 2, 3, and 4, please. I'd love to. The preventative strategies are crucial for
sure.
Us.
So really the easiest things are warming up in the morning. So the hot shower, the hot tub, the sauna, whatever you have access to, wherever you're staying at the mountain, think about warming up as helping your tissues stretch more. So cold things don't stretch so well. They tend to break. Warm things tend to stretch out a little bit more, like your elastic band. And so warming up in the morning is really one of the keys. And you can do that so many different ways, and whether that's stretching or yoga or hot tub or hot shower, but being warm when you get out on the slopes rather than just, you know, bucking up and jumping out there is really quite helpful. Number two, just feeling your, you know, training before season. Of course, we've all sung the song of preseason fitness training. We understand so much more about fitness now than we ever did before, and we've got such a wide variety of tools. And so to that part, I would say to you, listen, every other athlete, certainly every pro athlete, uses a coach and uses a trainer, and there's no reason why you shouldn't too. There are coaches and trainers everywhere around us, and if you want to enjoy your ski season more and stay out of my office more, use a trainer, use a coach. Don't think that you are going to do better than any pro athlete would do without, you know, just all on your own. It's just so, you'll get so much more out of it by training for the season and even mid-season as well. And then listening to your body during the day, as we mentioned before, noticing when you're getting tired, just being aware of yourself and your strength and your fitness and your mindset. And optimizing the time of day. And so if the weather's better, if the snow conditions are better, you know, at 10 or 11 in the morning, go out a little later. If it's nasty in the morning, be patient. And patience in all sport, but especially skiing and boarding, is one of the missing attributes of folks who just do things that they just knew they shouldn't do. They're in a hurry. They're in a hurry to get there. They're in a hurry to get to the lift. They're in a hurry almost to get down the mountain. And step back for a minute and think about why you're skiing and the beauty of the entire environment, and pause and take it all in. And then at the end of the day, don't just go to the bar. Take that time at the end of the day and feel where your body is a little stiff, a little tired. Think about stretching then a little bit, just loosening up at the end of the day. If you have access to a pool or a hot tub, great. Use ice at the end of the day for joints that are a little sore. It's a good way to keep the swelling down, and just being body aware is the best thing I can say.
I love that. And I love bullet points. So number one was essentially mindfulness in a way, right? Like, be mindful, be in the moment. You know, don't, like I did a few days ago, don't not think before you do something challenging. Warm up. I really like that. When I was a kid, I used to take a shower before working out. My dad always gave me a hard time. He's like, you're going to be sweaty. But I knew there was something about it that made me feel right. So I'm going to make him listen to this podcast. Told you, Dad. And then number three, get a trainer. Yep, fitness training, coaching. And then number four was essentially like cool down and take good care of yourself after your ski or ride. Beautiful. So thank you. Bullet points are key. So I think for all our listeners, none of us are doing all those things. So let's all see if we can step to that, because they keep us out of Dr. Stone's office, which is a good thing. So let's move on to, you know, your book. So I just downloaded the audiobook version of your book called Play Forever. And I'll be listening to that next time I drive across the desert in Nevada from Tahoe back to Utah or Jackson in Wyoming. And I'm curious, what am I going to learn from that book that will help me as a skier?
So much of what we just said and more. So I wrote the book for folks who often get injured and then have that, oh me, oh my, I'm not going to come back, or my year's over, or my career is over, or worried about ever being as good as they are. And if I could give you one pearl from that book, it would be, use your injury as an excuse, an opportunity to come back fitter, faster, and stronger than you've been in years. And so you may not have been thinking about training one side of your body or another, or your core or your back muscles or something else but now you've got a knee or an ankle injury that's slowing you down, or in your case, a shoulder injury. Mm-hmm. It means that every day, the day after that injury happens, into the gym, have a great trainer, have a great physical therapist, get a good, accurate diagnosis, and then design your rehab and fitness program, both to help your injured joint, but all the rest of you. So use that window of time to come back to your sport better than you've ever been. So all athletes get hurt. Great athletes use their injury to come back better. And that book talks a lot about how to thrive after injuries, how to prevent them, how to treat a lot of the ones that we often all get.
That's terrific. So I'm excited to read that. I just read the introduction. So all of those things are really important to me as a person, because skiing is my whole life. So anything that can keep me from getting injured or can get me back on the slopes quicker, I'm going to be very interested in. And on that note, let's talk more about me, Dr. Stone, because I think this is an interesting, point. I've had some complicated knee injury. So I'd like to just go through my knee injuries with you really quick, because I'm probably a good candidate from some of your knee procedures as well. So let's have a listen to this really quick, and then you kind of tell me what you think might be my best courses of action. You ready? This might be a little long, so I'll try to get through it quick. All the details aren't important, but here come all the details. So I blew my left knee jumping off a cliff in Japan in 2015, and I was 37 years old at the time. I fully tore my ACL, I vaporized my lateral meniscus, and I tore off a square centimeter of cartilage from the end of my, what do they call it, your lateral epicondyle of my femur, which is basically just the end of your femur that is in your knee. And my surgeon called it a 7 out of 10 bad knee injury. So, of course, I had the ACL replaced with my hamstring. I had the microfracture surgery where I'm missing the cartilage on the femur, where they drill little holes where you're missing the cartilage and hoping that something kind of grows back to help buffer the bone there a little bit. And the surgeon ended up leaving my meniscus alone because he said it looked like hamburger. So I recovered from that well from that injury. And 18 months later, I was skiing about as hard as ever. So fast forward to November 2021, and osteoarthritis caught up with me. And I could barely even ski. Tons of pain, lots of swelling. I took a month off of skiing. I did physical therapy, got a PRP injection. I also had hyaluronic acid put in there, which I guess is the gunk that's already in your knee. And after those injections, I got back to skiing, but the arthritis returned again in August. So I only made it from November to August before the pain was as bad as before. Then I got another PRP injection in October 2022, and I got back to normal skiing. It was fine for a year. So it seemed to work for me. So now I get the PRP injections in that lateral compartment of left knee every 3 months just to be safe, because I found a guy that does it pretty cheap. And so all the orthopedic surgeons that I have seen told me I'll need a half knee replacement soon because the left side of my left knee is damaged, and I'm only 45. So first of all, I'm curious, what's your reaction to my story?
So first of all, you always have to know the bias of your surgeon. So I'm biased. So I'm going to give you biased answers here. Okay. So
I like it.
It's not criticism of the choices your surgeon made or you made. Mm-hmm. But if you were coming here, we would make very different choices than what you had done to your knee. And as you can see, what you had done to your knee didn't work out because you took an injury that now led to significant arthritis. Mm-hmm. And so starting from the top, number one, we never use hamstring grafts in skiers. It weakens your ability to flex and angulate on the slope. And the outcomes of hamstrings are nowhere near as good as the outcome of using a patellar tendon or quadriceps tendon, or even an allograft. And so that's our bias. I realize that there mm-hmm. are many surgeons who use hamstrings. It's just having treated skiers for 30 years and looked at the results, our bias is we just would never use them. We would never use a microfracture on a large articular cartilage lesion. I trained with Dick Stebbin. We did lots of microfractures. I developed a technique in 1991 when I said to Dr. Stebbin, hey, what are you going to do when microfracture fails? And he didn't have a response for that. And mm-hmm. the technique that we developed was called articular cartilage paste grafting, where we grafted that damaged area in order to provide articular cartilage to the stem cells coming out of the bone marrow that would then regrow cartilage. We didn't know that there were stem cells then. Today, we call them stromal cells, but we understand that they're progenitors for regrowing cartilage if you give them the right matrix. And then number three, when a surgeon says your meniscus looks like hamburger, that means if it's not repairable, it should be replaced right away. because if you don't replace it, you can't protect that joint surface, and the joint will go down the path to arthritis that you've gone down. So now the question, as you fast forward, when I get so many patients who come in with your story, and it really depends on what the MRI, x-ray, and exam look like and feel like. If there's still joint space, we can still go in and graft that damaged articular cartilage, and we can replace that meniscus. If there's no joint space, then we're down the path usually of doing what you're doing with PRP and HA, helping buy time, but eventually doing a partial replacement for those surfaces. However, a lot depends on your exam as well, the mechanics of your joint, how you walk and run up and down the hall, the angulations of your leg, a host of mechanical things influence the type of surgery that we do to rebuild biologically an injured joint. So you've heard of my biases, you know, what we've learned over the years. We have a public nonprofit research foundation. And so we are following every one of these patients over the last 30 years and doing basic science research to figure out which of these injections and which of these techniques help, which of them can be optimized, which growth factors should we add to cartilage repair or meniscus transplant or ligament reconstruction. So we have a lot of data behind what we're doing, and we're working very hard to make all of these better.
Well, thank you very much for that. So it sounds like I could have done a lot of things different that may have led to a better result.
That's our goal.
Yeah. You know, and maybe not be in the position that I'm in right now, which feels like, you know, tumbling towards a half knee replacement at a much younger age than I should, ideally. And I guess on that note, what age is too young? What age is optimal for getting knee replacements?
So we try everything we can to rebuild knees biologically first. We try everything we can to, if we need to do an artificial component, to just do a partial replacement. So we can do an isolated medial or lateral or patellofemoral partial replacement. And the reason is that in a partial replacement, the knee feels so much more normal. Range of motion's better. It's less surgery. I just had a patient run across the United States and has two bilateral partial knee replacements.
Wow.
So people get back to sports quicker and, in our view, have fewer complications. So if you need, however, to have a joint replacement, if all three compartments of the knee or two compartments are severely worn out, then it doesn't matter what your age is. If you're living in pain, there's no point in living in pain. Life's short. You don't know how many decades you get.
Right.
So from our point of view, if you're living in pain, we need to solve the pain by whatever technique it takes. And given now that we can do these knee replacements without cement, robotically controlled, I think the likelihood is that they're going to last patients their lifetime. That's our goal. The plastic or high molecular weight polyethylene inserts can be replaced if you wear them out. But I almost never see athletes wear out their high molecular weight polyethylene inserts from skiing or from sports alone.
So these polyethylene inserts, how long would you guess they last? I mean, you're saying that it's lifetime, but
they're supposedly 30-year implants based on the wear testing in the lab.
Wow.
But I can tell you, I've been doing these for 30 years and I've only had one patient wear out their insert from sports. And every time I go to an orthopedics meeting, I ask for a show of hands that says, how many of you have ever seen one of these knees worn out from sports? And almost no one ever raises their hands. So I then say, well, why are you telling patients all these years they can't play sports if you never see them wear out? So, you know, we've taken a different approach over the years. And I think now without cement, it makes a really compelling argument for returning people back to sport. As you know, resistance exercise, weightlifting, climbing is the only good way to build bone. And as we're all aging, especially women faster than men, lose bone fast. And the point is, if we can keep them weightlifting, if we can keep them mountain climbing, if we can keep them doing resistance exercises, then they're likely to build their bone and they're likely not to let these implants come loose from osteoporosis. Additionally, the more they exercise, the more they strengthen their muscles, and the muscles help protect the joints as well. So we put a little chip in our patients, which makes them compelled to exercise every day for the rest of their lives.
I like that. And some really strong motivation there. So I gotta say, if just from as a layman, you know, somebody with a bad knee who of course is on Google trying to figure out what all the solutions are going to be, what my future might look like. I'm seeing, you know, these knee replacements last 15 years, they last 20 years. So hearing you say they would last the rest of my life is revolutionary. And to add to that, everybody that I know, because I harass everybody I know who's had a knee replacement, they all say, I wish I would have done it sooner. So it sounds like the advice might be, if you are really experiencing pain, if your quality of life is going down, you should really look into these, and I might butcher it, I forget what it was, polyethylene inserts, this style of knee replacement, because it very well may last you forever.
So let me explain. So all knee replacements have a metal cap on the femur and a tray on the tibia, which is usually titanium. Then between them, there's a high molecular weight polyethylene, which is very similar to PTEX at the base of your ski.
Okay.
And so that material is what permits the femoral component to move smoothly on the tibial component. I'll tell you a fun story about that. So
yeah,
quick fun regression story here. So you all know about, you may know about the material Phantom, which DPS skis developed to impregnate the bottom of your ski and have it be more lubricious so that you wouldn't need to add ski wax each year to your skis. Mm-hmm. And so we looked at that material because that material penetrates a ski base and lasts the lifetime of the ski base. So we asked the question, hey, could I use that material on a knee implant, the polyethylene component of a knee implant, and make that implant more lubricious and decrease the wear pattern in somebody's knee? Mm-hmm. It turned out the way we did the study didn't work out to show that, so we didn't progress with it, but that's the concept. So that material in a joint replacement, you can think about it as the base of your skis and you won't be very far off.
I like that a lot. And you've mentioned a couple times that your strategy for knee replacement doesn't involve cement. Can you tell us where is the cement involved and you know, how has that been a bad thing at some times and getting rid of it is a good thing?
So you know how when a dentist puts a cap on your tooth and they put a little amalgam, they put a little cement in there to hold it in place. Mm-hmm. Well, when surgeons put a total knee or a partial knee in patients, they traditionally have used a methyl methacrylate, a bone cement, to hold the components to the bone. And unfortunately, as patients aged, the bone cement interface would break down, especially as they became osteoporotic, and especially if they were told not to exercise. Mm-hmm. And so because of the onset of robotics, we can now make a 3D model of the patient's knee, place the implants on the model before we ever touch the patient, optimize exactly where they go. And then when I go to surgery, I can use a robotic arm to just remove the part of the bone matched that we matched on the 3D model. So we remove less bone and it's far more precise. So now when I put a metal component onto that bone, it fits on there perfectly and the bottom of the metal is porous. So the bone can grow into that porous weave and fix the metal to the bone without cement. Wow. That means once you've healed it in, which takes about 6 weeks, you're not going to knock it loose unless you break your leg.
Wow.
So I can let you go back to running and climbing and skiing as much as you want. You're not going to knock that component loose. And because the high molecular polyethylene has gotten so much better, the likelihood of you wearing that out is low as well. So the whole concept of knee replacements has really changed. I bought the first outpatient robot in the world, certainly in America, 15 years ago. And started doing these partial and total knee replacements robotically. I used to think I was a really good surgeon until I looked at how precise we could be with a robotic arm. And I realized that we were nowhere near as good as we could be. And that's what permitted us to get rid of the cement.
Wow, that's terrific. So for someone like me, if I end up getting a half knee replacement with you, for example, what would be my limitations? I've heard, you know, not probably jumping anymore, probably no more moguls. What limitations might a skier have after getting a half or full knee replacement?
So in the partial knee replacements, we still do use cement because the metal surface is so small, there's not enough room for the bone to grow into. However, we have also not limited our patients. So I mentioned to you, I had a patient who just ran across the United States on two partial knee replacements. And we have lots of skiers and mountain climbers and people doing track and field on these partials. Now, somebody's going to wear it out. Somebody's going to knock it loose. But it's going to take a long time. And we have so many patients playing full sports that our bias is that why not go out and play, build your bone, build your muscle. You're far more likely to, number one, be happy, and number two, to have a good knee than you are to knock it loose.
He's got a big smile while saying that, which makes me feel good. So maybe I could get a partial or full knee replacement and still do backflips.
So what? You're far more likely to injure something else in your backflip. But so what we do is on our website at stoneclinic.com, we offer to people to upload their X-ray and MRI, and there's no charge at all. And we look at those and talk to the patient on the phone or on a Zoom. And if it's appropriate, then we can guide you usually by the information you provide as to what you might be a candidate for. So if you look at stoneclinic.com and you can see the outside consult, and you're more than welcome to upload X-rays and MRIs and come talk to us.
Well, I might be doing that right after this call. So, because I am very curious on what my options are. And I've had a lot of anxiety about it, especially when I went through the osteoarthritis a couple of years back. And I obviously have anxiety about it if I'm getting PRP injections every 3 months. One other question I have on the knee replacement. So everything I've read, and I'm curious what your opinion is, it seems like full knee replacements do better in patients than partial knee replacements. But you kind of said something to the contrary earlier. But so if I'm hearing stuff like, oh, we can't use the non-cement strategy if you're a partial knee replacement. So I'm wondering, at that point, if you're someone like me, do I just cut out the good part of the knee too and go for the full knee replacement? Or is that just never done?
Absolutely not.
Okay. And tell me why.
The reason is that a full knee replacement is never normal. The mechanics are not like your normal knee. The stability is not like your normal knee. And if you develop pain, it's very hard to solve the problem because you've resurfaced everything.
Right.
A partial knee replacement leaves all of your mechanics intact, leaves your ligaments intact, leaves the good part of your knee intact. And so you always want to go for a partial replacement. If you have a competent surgeon who does them well, then do a full knee replacement whenever you can, because you're just treating the part that's bad. A good rule in medicine is never take any risks that you don't have to take, and just solve, you know, treat the part that's broken. Don't take on any more risk.
I think in the redneck society I grew up in, we'd say, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Calling all ski enthusiasts. Elevate your winter getaway with an all-inclusive experience at Club Med. The resorts in France, Switzerland, Italy, and Quebec offer a seamless blend of breathtaking ski adventures, locally inspired cuisine like fondue, and lively après-ski delights, all included in your package. So you can focus on conquering the slopes, indulging in the flavors, and creating unforgettable memories with your loved ones. Visit www.clubmed.us. Call 1-800-CLUB-MED or call your travel advisor to craft your ski dreams.
Another great question, I think, is you understand my knee on some level right now. What do you think I should do personally moving forward?
Upload your X-rays and MRI and let me give you good advice, not bad advice. And so we're pretty determined about that. Then when we counsel people about what to do, we want to really have data so that we give them good advice. And the best data is a careful physical exam combined with X-ray and MRI, and having our rehab team also look at the patient and understand from a fitness point of view where they're strong, where they're weak, where their mechanics are. And so we do a full analysis of people using the entire team to do that.
Terrific. Well, I'll be uploading my information because I do still have my X-rays. And I am curious about my big strategy, my only strategy right now is PRP. So, which is platelet rich plasma, which just for our listeners, they pull it out of your arm, your blood out of your arm. They spin it and centrifuge it a bunch of times. They keep pulling off the parts they like until they get down to those platelets. And then they inject it from, in my case, into the lateral compartment of my left knee where I have some damage. So how do you feel about PRP injections for knee? For knees, and tell us a little bit about what PRP is and how can it help.
So within the platelets in your body, platelets are a part of your blood. The platelets have these little granules called alpha granules, and they're rich with growth factors and cytokines, these chemotactic factors that have various effects in the body. And so when we combine the PRP, which is that those growth factors in the platelets, with hyaluronic acid, the natural lubricant of your joints, we inject those into all the joints in the body and as well a number of injured tendons when you get tendonitis. And it's a very potent tool that has a number of effects. One, it's anti-inflammatory. It's anti-fibrotic, meaning it diminishes scar formation. It's immunomodulatory, meaning it shuts down an inflammation pattern. And most importantly, the cytokines in that material recruit your body's own stem cells to divide and send their progenitors, their daughters, to the site of injury. And that's probably the most potent way that these work. And so you hear about people going to Mexico and going to Europe to get stem cell injections. We don't believe there's really a need for stem cell injections anymore. And the reason is that most of those cells die when they're injected. However, every one of you walking around, no matter what your age, younger, better than older, but still, all of you have billions of stem cells within your body. They're called pericytes. They live on the walls of vessels. And so our job, and especially in the Research Foundation, as well as here in the clinic, is to figure out what are the most potent chemotactic factors to recruit your body's own stem cells, your progenitor cells, to the site of injury? So we get the benefit, the local benefit of the PRP and the hyaluronic acid, and then we get the benefit of bringing the right cells to the right spot. So a lot of our research is on how do we get better and better growth factors. And I'll give you a hint, the hint of where those things are going to be are from birth tissues. So nothing's growing faster than the fetus. The reason the mother doesn't reject the fetus, even though the fetus is only half the mom, is because those cells and those growth factors are potently immunomodulatory. They shut down the rejection and inflammation phenomenon. And so we believe that a lot of the research going forward will be using birth tissues to augment these PRP and HA injections and have better recruitment techniques. Right now, the FDA has shut down a lot of that clinical work because they believe that these factors should be treated like drugs because they're so potent.
Wow.
And they're requiring the companies to go through a drug pathway before the FDA will approve it. So a lot of our research and our clinical use of this has been stalled. Not the research, but the clinical use has been stalled until the FDA comes out with better regulations around our use of these to recruit the body's own progenitor cells. However, that's the future. So right now, you're doing the right thing using PRP and HA as a way of modulating your joint pain and inflammation. I have lots of skiers who show up in our office in November of every year with x-rays that look horrible, bone-on-bone arthritis. And they say to me, hey, doc, I'm not letting you operate on my knee until that lube job you gave me doesn't work. And right now, when you give it to me in November, it gets me through the ski season. And I come back in the spring, get another one, but I'm not letting you operate on that knee. And the x-ray looks horrible. They look horrible the way they're walking, but it works so well that they just get through ski season. So I feel great about the fact that I keep them out of the operating room. Mm-hmm. I worry a little bit, am I helping them just to keep destroying their knees?
Oh.
But on the other hand, if they're already destroyed, I don't feel too badly. So I think these are potent tools. I think we're lucky to be in what I call this anabolic era of sports medicine. We no longer jam in cortisone, which degrades the tissue, inhibits healing. We have these PRP and growth factors and lubricants that can help the joint. So more power to it.
Terrific. Well, you already answered a few of the questions I was about to ask you about steroids and cortisone. So I think that the general understanding is don't get cortisone injections. And when I started, I was getting PRP plus hyaluronic acid together. And that was $2,000 a pop, and insurance does not cover that because it's not as proven as other things. So now I just switched to doing PRP. I found a person that will do it for $450 a pop. So that's why I switched. I was like, well, for the same price of getting one, I can get four a year. So I'm curious, what do you think about me getting four PRP injections a year? And do you think I'm missing out on anything by not getting the hyaluronic acid?
I think you are missing out. I think one of the ways that PRP works is by stimulating the lining cells of the joint to produce more HA, which is one of the potent ways that hyaluronic acid, potent ways that the thing works. Number two, I worry about too many needles going into joints that sometime or other somebody's going to possibly get an infection from that. Mm. And so in general, we try to reduce the number of times somebody puts a needle in a joint. We want the most potent injection possible and to last the longest.
So you would recommend two per year with the PRP injections, and you think I should do hyaluronic acid with it?
I'm not making a recommendation because I tell you that people vary widely. I have some patients who get a year, a year and a half benefit out of the combination injections, and we have other people it doesn't work for at all. And so you really need to listen to your own body and see what works for you. And you need to think through which risks you want to take. And you really also need a good analysis of what's the status of your joint. Meaning if you still have a joint that can be rebuilt biologically, it may not be a great idea to keep injecting lubricants and growth factors and destroy your joint. Mm-hmm. If you can keep yourself out of having a partial replacement, that's a good thing. So I think being thoughtful about what the right treatment is for each individual is important.
And the one thing, I took it a step back, I forgot to ask you, what is hyaluronic acid?
So the natural lubricant of the joint, it's a long chain polysaccharide that helps lubrication, really. It's the natural lubricant.
Terrific. Okay. And you already answered how you feel about stem cell treatment. You're not interested in that. And so what else have I got here? Oh, okay. So my surgeon who did my ACL, and again, he's biased and you're biased, but he told me not to get cartilage transplant because he thought the surgery was too invasive as it's an open knee surgery, is my understanding. What's your response to that surgeon?
Well, I never want to criticize or comment on another surgeon's point of view because everyone's entitled to it. Our cartilage replacement procedures are all arthroscopic. They're not open surgery.
Okay.
So, we think that that's a better approach than microfracture almost every time. Mm-hmm. But, I respect the fact that people have different points of view.
Okay. And someone in my knee position, if you will, what do you think the best movement for me moving forward is? What's the best strategy for preventative care?
Always, whenever you have an injury, get a very accurate diagnosis. Use the time to get a good physical exam, good x-rays, good MRI, update that if they're out of date, get a great physical assessment with a good physical therapist and trainer, and pull together a team to design an approach with the goal, as I write a lot in that book, Play Forever, to have you drop dead at age 100 playing the sport you love. And so in your case, we'd love to have you drop dead at age 100 skiing down a slope.
I need that, Dr. Stone. So, we got a little extra time here at the end. Let's talk about my shoulder. So I over-rotated a backflip 4 days ago. And when I landed, my hand was down, kind of where the tail of my ski is. And it was just a fluke thing. So my hand was down, my arm was straight. It hit the ground and my arm went up and over, up and over behind myself. And it popped out anteriorly. I've put as a mountain guide, I'm a wilderness first responder, and I've put a lot of people's shoulders back in. So I was able to get my shoulder back in within 3 minutes. So I think that was a good thing. And I've gotten my x-ray back and it was negative. I just went to the doctor yesterday. And when she went through all the motions, she thought my rotator cuff was intact, but she wasn't sure about my labrum. So I'm waiting. I can't get my first MRI appointment I could get is in 3 weeks from now, of course. And so I'm waiting for that to get a more definitive diagnosis. But what do you think I should do in the meantime? Because obviously you can't really comment on this until you saw or I had results from my MRI. But in my position right now, you know, it's been 4 or 5 days. What do you think the best course of action is for me right now?
So here's the story on these. And that's the first time you've dislocated your shoulder?
Correct. And I'm 45.
So there's a complicated argument about first-time dislocators. First mm-hmm. of all, you can't dislocate without tearing the labrum. So the gasket that keeps your shoulder in place, for your shoulder to get out, it's got to rip that gasket mm-hmm. almost every time. In mm-hmm. hyperflexible people, sometimes we see it where they don't tear the labrum, but almost everybody else tears
it. Yeah, that's not me. I'm very flexible.
Number two, if you're in a sport or a job or an environment where dislocating again is a life-threatening problem. So all of my kayakers, I always repair their labrum arthroscopically after any dislocation. Because when they do a high brace in a flowing stream, their life is at risk if they dislocate. Mm-hmm. So it's important to them to have a stable shoulder.
Yes.
So if you're in the backcountry and you're doing things where if you dislocate, your life is, you know, at risk, I think it's better to repair it on day one. Mm-hmm. If on exam, you've got a pretty, you know, unstable shoulder on testing, again, I think generally we repair those in athletes. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of other people, though, who have had one dislocation, never had another, and they're happy that they didn't go through surgery. On the other hand, your rehab and time to healing isn't that much different if you repair it promptly versus if you just rehab it alone, because basically you're going to protect your shoulder for the 3 months it takes, because it takes 3 months for that labrum to heal down if it's going to heal and mm-hmm. for your shoulder mechanics to come back properly. Clearly in the shoulder, a lot of my skiers go back and ski right away, even after dislocation, in either a sling or taping their shoulder or using a shoulder brace. But if they dislocate again, they're really at risk of injuring the shoulder quite a bit. So I think you need to just decide who you are and what your body is, what positions you're putting yourself in. Fortunately, labral repair is a very reproducible procedure now. It's two little holes arthroscopically. It's easy to do. It's under a local anesthetic for us. We do all these under a block.
Really?
You're awake. Yeah, well, we don't put people to sleep for those.
Oh.
So most of my athletes prefer to repair it right away and get going.
And so you did mention that it's about 3 months for either way. So if I did go through with the surgery, got the labrum repaired, what does the recovery look like?
It's immediate physical therapy and rehab. We use a sling to remind you not to put your arm in an unstable position. But basically, mm-hmm. we don't want you to get stiff. And so we want to start an early motion there and keep the shoulder mobile. I should be able to repair that labrum down well enough that you're not going to rip it out again in mm-hmm. normal, you know, rehab. So we'd like to have you fully strengthened and stable back by 3 months repaired. And obviously, a lot of folks are back earlier. But, you know, we tell you that by the time the tissues really heal and are healed strong and your shoulder mechanics are great, it just takes that amount of time to heal. It's another example where we give PRP in order to augment the healing. Usually at 1 month post-surgery, we'll also bloody the bone a little bit in order to bring out your own marrow cells at the time of surgery.
What's the procedure for bloodying a bone?
Just using a pick in order to bloody the bone around the glenoid to bring out more marrow cells into the joint. So we do all those little tricks to augment healing and hopefully speed it up and hopefully make it better. And we never actually look back in someone's shoulder and try to rip it apart at, you know, 1 month or 2 months. It may be healed well enough by then, mm-hmm. but we always tell people 3 months just to be safe.
And tell us really quick, my understanding is the glenoid is sort of the golf tee that the ball of your upper arm, your humerus, fits into. What is the glenoid? Just, you mentioned it.
I think you described it beautifully. So it's the part of the scapula where the upper part of the humerus rotates on. And that has that nice gasket around it that keeps your shoulder in place called the labrum. And when you dislocate, you rip that tissue in order to get the shoulder out of the joint.
So we do have just a tiny bit of extra time here. And I know that you have stories on top of stories on top of stories on top of stories. So are there any interesting stories about skiers or snowboarders with any kind of injury that you might be able to share that have gone through some kind of medical situation?
Well, I think, you know, one that's on our website, which is why I can use her name, Jen Hudak was a great example of a X Games skier who ruptured her ligaments, ruptured her articular cartilage and her meniscus. And we rebuilt all of that as a complete bio knee after she, cased the cope, as she says, on coming out of a super pipe. And then 7 months later, came back and won, X Games gold.
Wow.
So in the right driven athlete, each of these repairs can be repaired on day one, can be rehabbed aggressively, and you keep your athletic focus and you can come back to gold medal type performances.
I love that. And so one challenge that I've come up against, especially with the PRP injection, is health insurance. And so are a lot of your procedures covered by some health insurance companies?
Yeah, it really depends on what the kinds of insurance that people have. And I stay out of that part completely.
As you should. but essentially we could get a consultation and say, hey, I have United Healthcare. Would they cover this procedure?
That part I stay out of. Our team can counsel people and advise them a little bit. It's a mess.
Oh, it is. American healthcare is terrible. Most all of my injuries have happened in other countries. And people always say, oh my gosh, don't you get travel insurance or anything like that? I said, hell no. It's so cheap in these countries. It's like $300. They put you back together. Well, I appreciate all this, Dr. Stone. Is there anything else you'd like to share here at the end
of
the show?
So we love to share information. So I wrote that book, Play Forever. It's on Amazon. You can see that. And it's my effort at sharing the information about what we've learned around trying to come back from injuries and avoid injuries. As I mentioned to you, we do complimentary consultations at stoneclinic.com. And if people are interested in this kind of research, it's a public nonprofit research foundation. We're always trying to raise money and write grants and all the things you have to do for a public foundation. And they can look at that research at stoneresearch.org.
Terrific. Well, I'll be checking it out. I'll be uploading my X-ray, and I do have my MRI, I think. So I'll dig it up and send it your guys' way and see where I might sit on the spectrum, because I'd love to do whatever I need to do to optimize and ski forever.
There you go. I'd like to ski with you.
Well, let's do it. Let's stay in touch. Thank you so much for your time today, Dr. Stone. I greatly appreciate you. Thanks again, and let's make sure to talk soon.
Take care.
Thank you so much for listening to the Snow Brains podcast. If you liked this podcast, please share with your friends and family, and please subscribe. To find out more about Snow Brains, please visit us at snowbrains.com. You can also find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Snow Brains.
This episode of the Snow Brains podcast is brought to you by Club Med. Experience the ultimate ski getaway at Club Med, where every detail is meticulously taken care of. With their all-inclusive packages, you can focus on what you love most, skiing. With over 20-plus mountain resorts in the Alps, Japan, and Canada, enjoy world-class slopes, refreshing après-ski activities, and gourmet meals, all while knowing your accommodations, lift tickets, and childcare are all included. Let Club Med take the worry out of your ski vacation so you can simply relax and enjoy the ride. Visit www.clubmed.us. Call 1-800-CLUB-MED or call your travel advisor to plan your stress-free ski escape. This episode of the Snow Brains podcast was edited by Jared White and Ben Hout. Music by Chad Crouch. I'm your host, producer, and creator, Miles Clark.